Live from Chicago, this is Bruce Dumont with our Beyond the Beltway analysis of national politics, featuring occasional injections of rumor and innuendo, all offered by our panel of political insiders, pundits, power brokers, public servants, professors, and most importantly, plain-speaking Americans from coast to coast. Tonight featuring commentary by Anthony Anderson, Amisha Cross, Dan Johnson, and John Kochelko. Our program tonight coming to you from our home base at the Museum of Broadcast Communications in Chicago, where our toll-free lines are open at 1-800-723-8289. That's 1-800-723-8289. If you'd like to email us a comment, btb@museum.tv. And if you'd like to join us on the World Wide Web, www.beyondthebeltway.com. Well, the White House came out with a report card, a report. They looked into the problems of Obamacare on the website, and they issued a statement yesterday. And the report basically said that they ironed out more than 400 bugs. They've been fixed since the launch. The system is now stable 90% of the time. The website can now handle 50,000 users at any one particular time. And they went on to say that insofar as the changes in the program, small business open enrollment has been delayed now for 13 months. The business mandate has been delayed for one full year. And the individual mandate will not be delayed at all. That's what some of the folks want, at least some of the Republicans want done. But that is not going to happen. Amisha Cross is one of our Democrats tonight, and you work in this field. You're trying to encourage people to go to those sites. As someone who's on the front lines of trying to implement Obamacare, what is your report from the field as to how devastating these websites glitches have been?
From the field, I can say that it's had a negative impact in regards to individuals who've tried it. I think everybody knows that it took some people several times to even be able to get a username and password, which was, I think, frustrating not only for the individuals attempting to enroll, but also the in-person counselors who are working with them. That, I don't believe, was a fault of the administration as much as it was a fault of the organization that was paid to make sure that this thing actually went off without a hitch.
Are you surprised? I mean, 50,000 at one time doesn't sound like that big a deal. I mean, it would seem to me that in a country this large, you could easily have more than 50,000 people going on that website at any one time.
And that's one of the things that that the administration is working on currently. 50,000 is actually, and as you pointed out, a very low number in regards to how many people actually have to enroll to make this go off by the final phase. We want to see at least that much in certain parts of cities. I mean, Chicago as a whole, if you're looking at the Cook County area, we have larger than 50,000 people who need to enroll right now. So it is, again, a very small number, but it's a long way from what we started with.
Anthony Anderson is one of our card-carrying Republicans this evening. Anthony, nice to have you with us. In your neck of the woods, are people talking about Obamacare? Are they talking about these complaints? Or is this more about media hype of a government program not going
well? I think a lot of people are talking about it in my neighborhood. One of the things that always interests me is the way it rolled out is from its inception. Here you have essentially a website, which is basically Black Friday on steroids, in terms of the amount of people it was supposed to handle. Good. Now, it would seem to be that, hey, listen, we have to have both a presence on the web and a presence in these communities for which we were going to serve in the first place. So I don't understand why Obama didn't take the approach of, hey, listen, if Allstate has a presence on the internet and presence in the communities in terms of trying to sell insurance or State Farm or any other insurance agency, why isn't that the Obama administration tried to implement some of these things like you have in private industry to whereas you could actually service these members of the public, 300 million, as opposed to having to go to one website all at the same time?
One of our Democrats is Dan Johnson. Dan, you can't be happy with the way this program is rolled out. How devastating is it politically?
I think it's a good thing the election isn't next week, right? But I think it's more hype than real substance. You know, keep in mind that about half the states run their own exchanges. California is an example that's doing great. Those states that chose not to do their own exchange, like Illinois, unfortunately, we probably made a tactical error. But, you know, the website is probably 5 or 10% of the total package of Obamacare, including all the awesome things like no more pre-existing conditions can be a reason to prohibit somebody from buying insurance and no more lifetime caps. So I think
But are the snafus going to perpetuate a mistrust of the program? And are a lot of people just not going to sign up for it because they fear that it's not going to work well for them.
I doubt it. You know, like insurance, there are periods for open enrollment, and once you do it, you're in for years. So I think it's a lot of hype now that's not likely to have a lasting impact.
John Kochelko is our other Republican. John, you may have a different view.
I think that the administration's attitude, it's like someone looking at the wreckage of the Hindenburg and saying, you know, by November 30th, we'll reopen communications with the cockpit. This is a disaster. It gives the lie to the notion that this administration was you know, at the top intellectually. The president was one of the most brilliant men who ever lived, and
but he never ran anything.
No, that's it. He never ran anything, and his explanation of this, as with everything else that goes wrong, is that he didn't know anything about it. No one told him anything about this. He didn't know it. And he certainly would have never said it was going to work if anyone had told him that it was going to be the fiasco that it was. I think it's a disaster. I think it's only going to get worse.
Are you surprised that some heads have not rolled? Kathleen Sebelius,
given this administration, no. I think their attitude is, you know, we're okay. We're doing fine. And if you have a problem, it's your problem. I can't see him letting go of Kathy Sebelius. I mean, she's carried the water for him on other issues, on the, you know, all the problems that they had some months back with the Catholic Church. So I think that it's his style. Simply to deny and stonewall and not to hold
Alicia?
Anyone accountable.
I wouldn't necessarily say it's a denial. I will say that during the ongoing discussions and the rollout, I think that people have to understand that by the time it's actually rolled out, it's distances away from the president himself. I do think that in some instances, some heads probably should have rolled, but I also think that there is political chess going on right now.
But when he said during a campaign numerous times that if you have your health care and you can keep your health care, I mean, that was not the truth. People heard him say that, and he has not kept that promise.
Well, hold on that one in particular. Usually what that means is if you have a health insurance policy, which is really bad, but you don't know it's bad yet because you haven't been sick, you can't keep that anymore because it's illegal to have a very bad policy. That's true.
Dan, he didn't say it.
No, he didn't say that.
And I think that semantically, if he had have said it in that way.
He has even apologized for the way he said it, but clearly it was either a bold-faced lie and certainly it was misleading in a campaign.
The president made some mistakes from the beginning, but he is the commander in chief. He took way too many hits on this. He should have let the Kathryn Sebelius take a lot of these hits. He can't be president or commander in chief and webmaster at the same time. That was never his job. He was never meant to be the webmaster. You put that onus back on a company in which it was supposed to implement this whole policy and which was supposed to implement this whole website, not the president of the United States.
But again, he made the promise.
He made the promise, but he didn't build the site.
Well, the political
he was supposed to sign legislation. He did his job.
But the political damage about saying one thing and not living up to it.
I understand that.
That's a political issue.
That is an issue.
That speaks to truthfulness and candor, which allegedly was what he was going to bring to Washington.
Well, we don't know whether or not Obama really meant what he said when he said what he said either.
But he underlined it.
We don't know that.
He underlined it. He underlined it with that period. Remember, he said, you can keep your plan, period. He didn't say you can keep your plan if, you can keep your plan perhaps, you can keep your plan, and here's the asterisk, read the footnotes. He said you can keep your plan, period.
If it falls within the guidelines of ACA.
You can keep your plan until the end of this speech, apparently, is what
we're going to pause. 1-800-723-8289. If you want to comment on this, please do so. And when we come back, we're going to talk about a few other things. I'm Bruce Dumont. Thanks for being with us tonight. From Fort Wayne, Indiana to East Liverpool, Ohio, you're listening to Beyond the Beltway. Thank you very much for joining us tonight. My mother once said when I was growing up, Bruce, there's two things you never talk about in public, religion and politics. Well, Mom, I'm sorry, but we have talked about politics for many years, and for the next rest of the show, at least for a while, we're going to be talking about religion and politics because Pope Francis last week issued his personal reflections, a 50,000-word statement, and it really talked about the economic inequality that exists in the world. He talked about the idolatry of money. that permeates much of the world. And he went on to say also in a statement that sort of some Republicans might get bristled, he said something like this: some people continue to defend trickle-down theories, which assume that economic growth encouraged by free market inevitably successful in bringing about greater justice and inclusiveness in the world. This opinion, which has never been confirmed by the facts, expresses a crude and naive trust in the goodness of those wielding economic power in the sacralized workings of the privileged economic system. And some Republicans or some newspaper people have said in describing this, they said Pope Francis speaks out against everything Republicans stand for. So we have some Catholics on our panel tonight. We have Republicans on our panel tonight. And I want to first of all get a reaction from our Republican, because our Republicans are our Catholics around the table tonight. John Kochelko, when you heard and read what Pope Francis had to say, did you view it as an attack or a swipe at Reaganomics and conservative philosophy, as some opinion makers have done?
Not at all, because this document was written originally in Spanish. I don't believe trickle-down is a Spanish turn of phrase. I think this was an example of those who translated it being a bit cute and using the phrase in order to make it appear that he was specifically attacking Republican economics, which the Pope would not do. The Pope would not involve himself in the partisan political debates of the United States. He certainly is not condemning capitalism, as the Church has condemned communism, socialism, and national socialism throughout the years. The Church has, throughout its history, criticized aspects of capitalism, and that's what the Pope is doing here. He's offering thoughts, and we should bear in mind that this is not Church teaching. These are his thoughts with which Catholics are free to agree or disagree.
All right, I want to go to our other Republican, Anthony Anderson. As a Catholic and as a Republican, did you take any personal offense at what the Pope wrote?
Absolutely not. What the Pope said was absolutely right. All you have to look at is, take for instance, Illinois. We have a jail system such as 26 in California. Many people say that's where racism and poverty meet. You have an inordinate amount of people that's locked up for whatever reason, and you have this so-called Republican mantra of trickle-down economics. Well, it hasn't worked for everyone, and it's just a case for everyone to see right there before their eyes. So the Pope didn't have to tell me that. I knew it all along.
Were you cheering when you first heard this, Dan Johnson?
Oh, I thought it was awesome. I got a man crush on this
guy. And you're not Catholic.
No, I had a priest marry me, but I'm not Catholic. But, you know, look, it is a global debate. Austerity, governance, and politics is being pushed in every country in the world. And on the other side is investing in people. And I think the Pope, he's got, one of the biggest hearts of anyone on the planet, and his actions are touching people around the world. And to say the obvious, that if we don't invest in regular people, the so-called free market is going to leave billions of people in grinding poverty. And that's not, it's not a Catholic way, it's not a loving way to treat other human beings.
Amicia? Well, you're a Baptist.
I'm a Baptist, but my family actually is very Catholic. My mom always said that if somebody says something and you feel like the finger is pointed at you, it's probably because you're guilty. I feel like the Pope, in his expression, was saying something that we hear in several faiths around the country. Greed is something that Americans, as well as people outside of this nation, have to deal with. There is a bilge jar economy where you have a certain percentage of people who are extremely wealthy, and everybody else, well, fend for yourselves, do whatever.
But are we the greediest country on earth, or are we the most benevolent country on earth, or are we both?
You could argue benevolence, but I would probably say we're a little bit of both. It depends on where the tragedy strikes. Obviously, when there's a tsunami, when there's a hurricane, we're people who are definitely there, even if it doesn't occur within this nation. But there are problems within our own communities that we don't step to at all.
John?
Greed is not something that is limited to the wealthy. Anyone who has seen the fistfights and riots breaking out the last couple of days at these Black Friday sales, with people fighting over a flat-screen TV or a toaster knows that those were not Rockefellers or Vanderbilts that were there fighting over those items. Greed is something that you find in all levels of society.
But the process
is we are the most benevolent society in the history of the world.
I think that was more stupidity than anything. That was more stupidity. I don't see why people would do those things. As a matter of fact, while sales go from before Thanksgiving and well after Thanksgiving, why would you put yourself in a situation where you're going to be in a stampede to get a product that's going to go down in price in the first place?
We're a political show. How will the political climate, how will political leaders, how will people who have read this document or read about this document, will it change their actions in any way?
Unfortunately, I don't think it's going to change their actions because they're so enamored in what they believe in. For the most part, the hard right is going to be where they are. They're going to believe in their whole mantra of, government is bad, period, end of story. There's nothing the government can do. They can never be nimble enough to serve the public, period.
The Pope is opening up a conversation that for the pious, and we've got a particularly high percentage of pious people in America. For the pious that take, particularly Christians, that take Jesus' teaching seriously, Jesus looks a lot like a lefty radical by his actions throwing money changers out of the temple.
Absolutely.
And there's been an interesting discussion here that for people that are driven primarily by their religious beliefs, whether to continue to say, I'm primarily driven by, respect for the unborn, in their phrase, resistance to gay marriage or respect for the traditional family, or whether they start to open up more and say, the poorest among us and the most vulnerable among us, I want my government to reflect my values that they are protected as well.
John? The economy of the Roman Empire in the first century AD bears no relation whatever to the economy of the United States in the 21st century. Christ was dealing with a completely different world society in that time frame, and you can't in any way apply that to a condemnation of the United States. Capitalism produces greater wealth, greater security for a greater number of people than any economic system that has ever been devised. Certainly better than socialism.
But it's certain, no,
Christ was not a left winger, as you said. That is absurd.
I don't think that the Pope was arguing against capitalism at all. What I do think, again, is that he was arguing against the process of or an ideology that wealth is spread. Because it's technically not. We don't see that happen in the majority of nations. The wealthy have a certain thing called wealth protectionism. They protect what is theirs, and they make it in a way to where it's kind of hard for people to rise above. Most people who are born within a certain class remain in that class their entire lives. So you can't tell me that there's a trickle-down effect going on.
That's
not
the United States of America. And I would argue
that's the entire country and nation.
The Pope comes from Latin America, where I would argue they have never known real capitalism. They've never known American-style capitalism.
He has a worldwide
known a politically connected form of capitalism, where if you're plugged into the general who's running the country, or if you're plugged into the Perones, in the case of Argentina, you get the concession, you get to run the business.
That's not what Brazil's been in the last couple decades. It's been one of the economic success stories of the world. And to your earlier point, it's not a simple question of capitalism versus socialism. It's all a question of degrees and kind. Is it totally deregulated financial sector that caused the Great Recession? Is that purer capitalism? Or would it be smarter and more humane to have some regulations on our banks so they don't crash the economy? Or to have higher minimum wage?
We've had regulations since the 19th century. We've never had unregulated capitalism in the United States.
There was always
regulation, beginning at the state level in the earliest days of the Republic.
The Pope has referred to it as a new tyranny. That's a quote that he used, a new tyranny, that we have an era of a new tyranny. Do you feel that strongly, Anthony?
Well, absolutely. I mean, Bruce, the proof is in the pudding. All you have to do is look at the haves and the have-nots and the distance between those who have the means to do what they need to do and those who don't. And that distance is growing further and further apart. It's obvious for anybody to see.
Do you believe that those who have power have deliberately used that power to expand this divide?
Or has it just concentrated the power and it concentrated their wealth to do just that?
Give me some specifics. Where do you think that happened?
For instance, anytime you have a CEO of an organization where his average compensation once he retires is 6,000 times greater than the person at the very bottom in his company. Mm-hmm. If you don't think that that's not right, or if you think that that's right, then you must be living on another planet because that's part of the inequality that goes on year in and year out. And you'll never be able to break that poverty cycle until we break that cycle to whereas the average CEO would want to compensate the average person in a way that they can raise a family.
So in your particular, let's stick with that because, again, I think people can understand people that are making $20, $30 million a year because they read about them periodically. What would your solution to what would your solution be? Would it be that there is a cap on what a CEO can make?
I don't necessarily believe that there should be caps on what CEOs make, but I do believe that certain individuals in a company should at least be given a wage that is conducive to raising a family, at least.
Should, all right, let me ask it a different way. Should any person who's a CEO who's making anywhere from, let's $10 million, $20 million, $30 million a year, should anyone, or a baseball player, should anyone that's making that much money sleep comfortably at night because of what the Pope said? Amisha?
I think they're going to sleep comfortably at night regardless. They're just going to ignore the Pope. But whether or not they should actually...
But how should they feel? So a baseball player that makes $30 million a year, how should he feel when he walks outside of that ballpark and sees poverty as, you know, little kids asking him for autographs? That's the question.
I don't think that they make moral judgments and arguments about their cash.
I'm not so sure they make moral judgments.
Everyone should. That's the
point. We do have to pause. You think we should? Let's talk about that when we come back. 1-800-723-8289 is the phone number. How much is too much compensation? Are too many people getting too much money? Back shortly. Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. We are talking about Pope Francis in this portion of our program. We're getting a lot of calls. We're getting good heated conversation around the table, even during the commercial breaks. Let's introduce our guests, or let them introduce themselves. We'll begin with one of our Democrats, Dan Johnson.
Hi, Dan Johnson. I run the lobbying firm Progressive Public Affairs, father of two, husband of one.
And Anthony Anderson.
Chairman of Republican Precinct Project, a statewide organization dedicated to filling every Republican precinct in the state of Illinois.
And what do you do professionally?
Work for the Department of Juvenile Justice. I've been there for the last 20-plus years now.
And you're a Republican. Why?
Absolutely. I'm a Republican because I believe in limited government, Bruce. I really do. I believe that one of the things that we can do around here is make things right. There's a place for government, but I don't think it's where people think it is right now.
Amisha Cross.
Miss Black Chicago 2013, and I am also working with Enroll America, making sure that people across the state of Illinois understand the rights that they have now under the ACA and get enrolled.
And John Kochelko.
John S. Kochelko. I was a state representative and served as town assessor in Cicero. I do a lot of public speaking and love to do political commentary.
And a frequent guest on this program.
Thank you.
We are going to take calls. Let's go to JJ because we were talking about the compensation of corporate executives and whether or not they deserve it. And do they feel guilty by getting those big bonuses and those big paychecks? JJ, you're a truck driver and you're on the road in Indiana?
I'm in Illinois right now, sir.
Okay, good. What can we do for you?
Well, this is what... You know, the whole ball of wax is, you know, if you work hard, do you deserve that money? You know, what gives people the right to try to judge somebody because he makes more money than the next man? It sounds like to me it's just a bunch of jealousy going on.
JJ, let me ask you a question, and because I frequently ask this of myself, not because I'm a wealthy person, but when I read that someone makes 30 or 40 or 50 or 60 or $110 million a year, is anyone really worth that much money?
Money is something that a man made. When God said in the Bible, he said that a man's just his life is worth more than gold. So money has no place value on a person's human body. It's just something that a man made and put a price on it, you know?
But when you hear us, and I want to ask everyone this, when you read stories of celebrities or corporate CEOs that make, you know, an ungodly amount of money, and there's my term, an ungodly amount of money. I inadvertently slipped there.
Right.
But recently in Chicago, Michael Jordan is trying to sell his mansion. $28 million.
It was on the market for $29 million.
Right, and no one is buying. And now they were going to have an auction. Okay. But when you have someone like Michael Jordan who makes the money that he makes and still does very well, and he's trying to sell a $28 million mansion, and it has 16 bathrooms, and it has 32 rooms, or whatever the case may be. And by the way, he's not the only one. It was very highly publicized in Chicago. And yet, within 10 miles of where he lives and within literally three blocks of where he made all his money and his fame came from, there are people who cannot make ends meet. How does someone go to sleep and sleep comfortably knowing that? I don't know how many people feel that way, but I certainly do.
And that's my problem.
And money has never been my God. I'm not a wealthy person by any stretch of the imagination.
And to further that point, Bruce, here you have a corporation, XYZ, whatever it is, and that corporation is paying its employees so low that that employee is qualifying for some sort of SNAP program, SNAP benefits. Now, that one person we've got to pay, the government has to pay, because the CEO of XYZ don't want to pay that person. So one way or the other, government or the people is going to pay for it. So you either pay for it on the front end or the back end. And right now, the taxpayers are getting screwed because corporations don't want to pay.
I think to your point, Bruce, you know, if you step back and look at the long view, we're living at a time of savage inequality. The gap between the top 1% and the rest of us has grown to levels that hasn't been seen in this country since the 1920s. And it's not just because the top 1% of the 1% are doing so well. It's because everyone else is proportionally not doing well. Real wages have gone down. And though it's largely a consequence, and this is to go back to your point, of government policies that have largely driven upward distribution of wealth.
And I'm talking more about I'm talking more about people. I'm talking about people who come from humble beginnings. Mm-hmm. I mean, Michael Jordan came from humble beginnings. A lot of people in the NBA came from humble beginnings. All people in show business came from humble beginnings, and then they become billionaires. It doesn't seem to me, unless I'm missing a story here, it doesn't seem that they are proportionately giving back to help people who've been left behind. And I don't mean necessarily a handout, but why isn't there a Michael Jordan public school on, you know, throughout the west side of Chicago? I know there's a boys club. I mean, it's not like he hasn't done anything, but it seems to me you add him and you add Oprah and you add all these other people. I mean, you're talking about hundreds of billions of dollars don't appear to be shared with those that have been left behind.
I would argue, Bruce, that as people move up the economic ladder, part of that moral responsibility is depreciated. And it's really sad, especially for people who come from those, as you stated, humble backgrounds and humble beginnings, because their earnings do not mirror what they're doing within those communities, specifically towards the populations that they used to be a part of.
Right.
And that's not only for athletes or celebrities. That's also for people who become doctors, lawyers, whatever, from those communities.
Right.
Their actual level of give back is really small as well. So I think that us culturally, we need to look at that and see what it is
that
along
that
trajectory.
I'm going to ask a loaded question here. Is that unique to the black community?
No. I would say that the black community definitely has a major problem with it.
They have a problem with philanthropy, absolutely.
In general.
Tell me what. Why? Why?
I feel that most blacks view, you know, I've made it, so, you know, I've made it pretty much on my own. So now, hey, listen, it's your turn. Go make it and make it on your own, like everybody else.
One thing that I think that the Republican Party has hammered on very well that African-Americans have taken in is that bootstrap mentality. If I can do it, then you should be able to do it, too. And if I was able to do it without help, which I don't think anybody gets anywhere without somebody's help, then everybody else should be able to do that. There's no reason for me to have to reach back.
John.
A couple of quick points. I can't speak to Michael Jordan as an individual, but in general, charities would not exist in this country if it were not for the wealthy. They donate enormous sums of money to charity.
That's true.
And the church in particular, the church would not have money to use for charitable purposes if it did not receive that money from affluent people.
Well, I mean, but the regular donor base
poor people do not make donations
that's
to the
not
church
true.
At the
that's
level at the
also,
level
that's
they
not
enable
true.
But they do it
yeah.
more
make
people.
Another point.
I think poor people
let me finish my point. The 1% that are the much maligned 1% are paying over 25% of federal income taxes. They're funding the redistribution of income that President Obama advocates. If it wasn't for the wealth of that 1%, he wouldn't have the money to redistribute to people in the underclass.
Well, according to the Internal Revenue Service, that 1% that you're talking about, it's about 400 or so families. they make more than 40 million Americans. Is that the 1% that you're advocating
they
for?
Make, they
I
make,
mean, are you serious when you say that?
Are you serious when you say that people
with lesser means don't even donate to their churches? Are you serious?
No. Anthony,
they donate as a proportion,
Anthony,
too.
Anthony, let John speak.
Of course, ordinary people. But I'm saying at the level the church needs in order to distribute money for all of its charitable efforts, they receive a lot of money from affluent people, from rich people.
These people who also
And as far as the 1%, the 1% earns about 15 or 16% of the income, and they pay over 25 or 26% of the income taxes. They're paying taxes out of all proportion
of
to their earnings in the economy.
So,
Dan.
So a lot of facts are incorrect. Number one, the biggest charitable organizations in the world are the churches, and the bulk of their charitable contributions come from people of modest means. The 1% that has all this wealth is not the source of most philanthropy and most charitable contributions. They get all the headlines, but the everyday bread and butter comes from modest people passing the plate. Number two, the one
about churches now.
Yeah, church. Absolutely. They're by far the biggest philanthropic organizations in the world, and most of the money comes from people of modest means. And their percentage, their per capita giving, is far higher than 1%ers. There are certainly a few exceptions.
But the people, as you say, who are coming from that station in life, they're putting money plate is passed each Sunday. Yeah. They're putting money in there, or they're tithing a percentage of their income, and that money is going to help poor people, generally speaking, right?
I'm also
in some cases, it's going into the building fund to build a newer, parsonage for the person.
Right.
But and I did not say that the 1% are funding churches. I'm saying people who are well off. The money the churches receive in the main, the large sums of money that they receive, come from people who have enough disposable income that they can afford to contribute to their church. And that includes people of what you would call modest means. But it's people in the middle class, the upper middle class, and they're the people who are paying the freight in our society for the underclass that receives everything.
I want to go back to a question I asked about 20 minutes ago. Does anybody at this table think there's going to be any significant change in attitudes because of the focus that the Pope has put on this?
I honestly do.
What about you, Alicia?
I don't think so. What I think is that there's going to be a significant change in attitudes towards Catholic Church because he is the leader there. I don't necessarily think that people who already have this mindset are going to change it. I think that they're going to balk against what he said and his leadership and voice as a whole.
But I think it'll bring a substantive conversation. But other than that, if anything becomes of it, it's for us to know and see, I guess.
Everyone picks and chooses. The same people who despise the church because of its position on abortion or the fact that they don't have a female priesthood are cheering because they agree with what they've heard on this particular letter. So everyone picks and chooses which portion of Catholic teaching they approve of in terms of the political discourse. So I don't see that that's going to be a serious problem.
We've got to pause. 1-800-723-8209. As you can imagine, we have a full board of lights. Everybody wants to get in on this conversation. But again, write the number down, 1-800-723-8209. Back with your calls when we roll on from Chicago. Bruce Dumont back. Let's go to calls. We've been waiting for them. Let's go to Lewis, listening to us on our flagship station, WLS. Go ahead, Lewis.
I don't think the Pope was condemning all capitalism. He used the word unbridled capitalism, and I think he was referring to things like crony capitalism and the Wall Street bailouts, and I think you'll find people on both the right and the left who agree with him.
I think generally you're right in the sense that capitalism is a great growth engine for wealth, but I think he's also saying you can't just let it – either it's crony capitalism or unbridled capitalism or capitalism without any human conscience, which basically means distributing more of this wealth we generate to people of modest means, buying things like schools and hospitals that anyone can use for free. So I think you're right. It's not sort of – capitalism's a bad thing, but it needs to be harnessed to the direction of all people.
John?
You have to remember, the church and popes have been making this point for more than 100 years, going back to Leo XIII, who spoke a great deal and wrote a great deal about social issues and the economy. So this is nothing new. The church has criticized specific points of capitalism and has called for levels of regulation of capitalism for more than a century. This is just an expansion of what the church has taught for a long, long time.
Let's go to Sue in Dana, Illinois, also listening on WLS. Go ahead.
Hello. I agree with that last caller you had that, you know, a lot of your conversation sounds like jealousy, because in the Bible, Jesus said that there'd always be the poor with us. And in the beginning of the religion, they tried that, where everybody came in and pooled all their goods and their money and everything and divided it equal. And then they had to stop it because, of course, that there were some people slacked off all the time and didn't do their work. But I think that it's up to God to judge all these rich people or any of us and nobody else. If they don't want to give, they don't have to. They'll get judged in the end, and that's up to God, not us. And, I mean, I'm not rich by a long shot, but actually, by your standards, I'd be very poor. But it's like, you know, in the Bible, all we need is water, shelter, and a little clothing. It's all inside you if you have happiness.
Well, Sue, can I ask you, if it was up to you, do you think millionaires, as a bill's been introduced in Congress, should millionaires pay a higher percentage of their income in taxes to help fund things like public education for everybody, in your opinion, given what you believe about God? And
I wouldn't really have an opinion, because that would be up to them.
No, I'm saying, if government policy, you're voting, do you want to vote for the candidate who says, yes, millionaires and billionaires should pay a higher percentage of their income in taxes to the benefit of everybody, or no, they should not pay a higher percentage?
I don't know. I'm not saying either way, because that would depend on how that money got used, whether it would even go to good use or not.
Yeah, because it could also be wasted.
But also, what I would like to say about Obamacare is that, you know, there's such a thing as Medicaid. And instead of trying to change the whole system, he should have just upped the Medicaid, and these people that he was feeling so sorry for that didn't have insurance, then he should have reviewed each their individual case. And then if they deserved the Medicaid, instead of that they really couldn't afford insurance instead of buying all their, you know, luxuries and stuff, well, then he could have just had them all on Medicaid instead of making all these other people that were buying their own insurance and that lose their insurance.
Sue, listen, thank you very much for your call. We appreciate it. Let's go to Ray in Benton Harbor, Michigan on WLS. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hello, John. I'd like to address the question that John posed. Central South America never experienced real American capitalism. We can go back to the 1930s, 1940s. General Smedley Butler, two-time Congressional Medal of Honor winner, he said when he... all of the incursions that he went into South America to secure American capitalism, he said he was nothing more than a gangster for U.S. capitalism. And we could take that to Pinochet's Chile, where a democratically elected socialist government did not fit the ideal of capitalism, according to Nixon and Kissinger, and there had to be coup d'etat. No, John, they know what U.S. capitalism is. They know, and the corporate elites want to bring it here.
All right, let's let John respond, Ray.
Well, what you're talking about has nothing to do with my point. I'm saying that in most of Latin America, in all of Latin America, they've never known American style private enterprise, free enterprise. Chile is a partial exception. Under Pinochet, they did move toward a market economy. They put in reforms, Thatcherite type reforms, and their economy flourished because of that. Most of Latin America has not done that. They've had crony capitalism. They've had state capitalism. They've had capitalism connected to the leadership. And what you're talking about in terms of American foreign policy, that has nothing to do. Chile was of interest to Kissinger and Nixon because it was a threat to our national security, not to capitalism.
Ray, thanks very much for your call. During the break, Dan, you were making the point about the important role that Catholics play in determining who is elected president of the United States.
Yeah, I think one of the reasons this Pope's reflections, reviews are so important is that among swing voters, the people that decide elections in our country, Catholics are disproportionately represented. You know, they're kind of conflicted, right? They've got their faith on the one hand that says maybe I should be with Republicans because maybe I'm pro-life. On the other hand, maybe I should be for Democrats because there's a social justice stream to Catholic thinking. The Jesuits, as an example, right? So the fact that this Jesuit Pope is emphasizing the social justice wing of Catholicism, I think means among those Catholic swing voters, I think they are going to engage with it more. I think they will think about it more, and I think that may tilt them more to the Democratic side come November.
To some extent, you see people, even in the state of Illinois, grappling with this problem, especially when it comes to some issues such as gay marriage. I mean, we have our leadership, which are predominantly Democrat, but they also are Roman Catholic or Catholic in nature, mm-hmm. and they're having this problem too. I mean, what I know, dogma says this, and I'm on the political side, I have to do this. So they're caught in a mix of it, but this gets up to the conversation that
when
we
it comes
have to
right
have
down to it, they'll follow the politics.
Yeah, when it comes down to it, they'll follow the politics.
They'll turn their back. You know, hey, we can bend a little bit. Mm-hmm. Things do happen. We do have to pause. That is the end of hour number one if you're listening to this program on radio. And again, I want to thanks to Amesha Cross and Dan Johnson. They've been our Democrats in hour number one, Anthony Anderson and John Kochulko. They have been our Republicans in the first hour of our broadcast. If you're watching this program on television in Chicago, we will see you next week. If you're listening to this program coast to coast on radio and on WLS, our flagship station in Chicago, we have another full hour. Telephone lines will remain open at 1-800-723-8029. We'll continue this discussion, but also we'll bring up four new topics for your discussion when we continue from Chicago. I'm Bruce Dumont. Live from Chicago, this is Bruce Dumont. We continue with hour number two of Beyond the Beltway. Tonight featuring commentary by Republican Anthony Anderson, Democrat Amesha Cross, Democrat Dan Johnson, and Republican John Kochulko. Our phone lines remain open at 1-800-723-8289. That's 1-800-723-8289. If you'd like to email us a comment, btb@museum.tv. And you can always join us on the World Wide Web, beyondthebeltway.com. The audio and video portion of that show is usually available within 48 hours of the broadcast. So if you want to go to the website, if you miss a show, or you can actually go back many, many years and go into the archives. We have both radio and television waiting there for you. And we probably have you, Dan, from 10 years ago, 15 years ago.
I went browsing last night. I couldn't sleep.
Were you listening to all your shows?
I it was like Netflix. I binged.
A binge, a BTV binge. We are going to be talking about a variety of things in this portion of our broadcast, but I do want to begin, John Kochulko. I know that foreign affairs is one of your pet topics, as was demonstrated in the first hour. But explain to the audience the potential devastating nature of this split now between China and Japan and the United States and these two islands that are now the focal point of an international, at least discussion, if not an incident yet.
It is very dangerous. The Chinese have taken a huge swath of the South China Sea and saying it's a special air defense district and that no other country can send aircraft into that zone without first clearing it with Chinese air controllers, which we reject, and we sent two B-52s unarmed without notifying them. But this opens up a real danger because China and Japan, as well as Taiwan and Korea, have claims to these little rocks in the middle of the sea, which are important because it's allegedly they sit atop reserves of natural gas and oil. It's interesting that China is still in this territorially acquisitive stage. You know, the United States at the end of World War II could have taken any territory we wanted in the Pacific. I mean, nothing could have stood in our way. We're the most powerful nation the world had ever seen. And President Roosevelt had a policy. We weren't going to take anything. We weren't going to make any territorial acquisitions because of our victory in World War II. China is fighting over these two or three little rocks. And it's a very dangerous situation because it indicates that China is feeling its oats. They now have an aircraft. They have built their first big deck aircraft carrier. They are emerging as a major military power. And they are challenging our allies, the Japanese, the Koreans, Taiwan, potentially Australia. It's probably going to drive those countries closer to the United States. It's going to make them realize even more than ever that they need America's umbrella of protection.
But it has also triggered a reign of nationalism in Japan. Because they were prohibited at the end of World War II from having a strong military. Right. They now have a maritime navy, which was rather significant.
Right.
But the idea of waking up the giant of Japan is very real. It's a growing sense in Japan.
And even though Japan spends a relatively small percentage on national defense, their economy has been so big that they have a very significant military force. People don't realize they have a very significant Navy, Air Force, Army, even with all the restrictions we think of that came out of World War II. And yes, this is engendering sort of 1930s style nationalism, territorial acquisitiveness. I mean, they want those islands. They're currently administering the islands. Right now, Japan is administering those islands, and China is laying a claim to them. If they push that claim, there could be difficulties.
Dan is one of our Democrats tonight. Dan, do you view China as a friend of the United States, as someone to be feared by the United States? What are your concerns about China and its future relationship with the United States and its future role in the world?
I think I think China is probably in the last two decades the biggest shift from rural poverty to urban middle class that the world has ever seen, and the hundreds of millions of Chinese people that have gone from illiterate peasants to what we would consider a middle class lifestyle is astonishing and wonderful and a triumph for human history. So I don't fear it. I welcome it. I think it's great. I noticed sort of on that point, China this morning sent up a rocket to the moon, their first soft moon landing, Jade's Kitten, they're calling it. And so, immediately I thought, well, great, maybe our NASA budget can go down a little bit and we can collaborate on figuring out how to, pay for the International Space Station and moon exploration. But to your point, I think a wealthy China, just like a wealthy Asia, middle class Asia, I think that's a great thing. And I think with strong diplomacy, there's no reason to think that we're ever going to go to war with
them. But if we have a wealthy and growing economy in China, and it also wakes up Japan, I mean, Japan certainly has woken up economically, but I'm talking about if they move from their constitution is a pacifist constitution. But the mood of the people and with the new leadership in Japan, they don't want to be pushed around. They want to be a player. I mean, they see if someone is a player in the world, they're treated differently. Are we looking forward to perhaps growing conflicts between not only within the Korean Peninsula, but also Japan in that mix
as a conflict for the most part, because I mean China is one of our partners in terms of economics, and they hold a lot of our debt, and so it would be in their best interest to maintain the relationship that we do have between the nations, because if they don't, then they stand and lose a lot of money and a lot of reputation there.
Amisha Gross, where do you come down on? Do you view this century as perhaps being the century of the Chinese, not the century of the United States?
I wouldn't necessarily push it that far. I do think that the Chinese have made leaps and bounds. I personally was extremely excited when they threw down the one-child policy. I thought that was ridiculous. And I think that progressively, in terms of their economics, they are expanding and have done so at a very rapid rate. I would not turn a blind eye to China, because China knows how competitive they are, and they do seek and have always, for quite some time now, sought that top spot. So I would definitely say that they see themselves, in some senses, higher than the United States currently.
John, do you agree with that?
I think that China is analogous to Germany at the end of the 19th century, the beginning of the 20th century, rising economic power, but surrounded by powerful countries that don't want to be dominated by China. Japan, South Korea, Taiwan, India in particular. India, which is going to outstrip China in terms of population very shortly. Right. Their economy is growing. And those countries see the United States as their benefactor. We're powerful, but we're far away. And they understand that America is not a threat to their sovereignty. It's not a threat to their security in the way that China potentially could be. So they're going to, by nature, they're going to gravitate much more toward the United States. We're going to be the balance against China.
Then why is this cat and mouse game that's going on in the China Sea right now? Why is that going on? Is it just, as you say, it's a bunch of rocks? It has no economic power. Is it a macho showdown with the people in the region?
China feels it has this big economy. It's this building military power. They want to flex their muscles. And like any other power, they're going to see how far they can push before they get pushed back. And if there was no pushback, they would have benefited. But the fact that they're getting a pushback, I think, has led some in China to say that maybe this is not the best idea. There's apparently been some thinking in China that maybe this wasn't wise, because what do they do for an encore? They say we have this zone, and you must abide by it. But if the United States doesn't abide by it, what do? Do they shoot down an American aircraft? I don't see that happening. No.
So they've sort of drawn a line in the sand, and then they have...
And then what do you do to back it up?
We had a president that drew a line in the sand, and then we went out of the way, and we've made friends with Iran.
I'm not an enthusiastic supporter of that.
Triumph of diplomacy.
And we're going to talk about that when we come back. 1-800-723-8289. I'm Bruce Dumont from coast to coast and border to border every Sunday night on America's great radio stations. Nice to have you with us tonight live from Chicago. Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. Thank you very much for joining us. We're now going to continue with something that we begun on this program several weeks ago, and that is in the second hour. We ask our guests to kind of bring to the table a subject that's sort of near and dear to the heart, something that's either flying under the media radar or it's just something they want to get off their chest. And Amisha Cross, we're going to turn to the Democrats. John talked a little bit about China and Japan. What do you want to put on the table? What do you think is uncovered?
I would probably say, and I don't want to necessarily say that it's uncovered, but I will say that it doesn't receive the amount of media attention it probably should, and that would be the cradle-to-prison pipeline. Being a member of a minority community, the African-American community, and seeing how many young people are, quite frankly, their lives are cut short because they are taken from an impoverished situation and automatically placed in a jail cell. A lot of these individuals could be rehabilitated. They could have an opportunity for progress if they were educated by better communities, if their school systems weren't shut down, if they were given an opportunity and a chance, and if the laws that are created would protect them in certain ways and not necessarily be non-colorblind. I feel like in a lot of situations, there are young minorities who are placed in these situations when people of other racial backgrounds are doing the exact same thing and are not placed in the same situations as minorities happen to be. And everyone knows that once you get a strike against you, criminal record-wise, being an African-American male, the chances of you getting hired full-time or getting hired at a job that actually allows you to be able to provide for a family are slim to none.
Now, Anthony, you work in the juvenile justice system. You have for about 16 to 20 years, right?
20 years.
Okay. Pick up on that conversation, and from your perspective, who are the people that you see and how many of the people you see you're happy that they're behind bars?
Well, there's a lot of people out there. One of the things I wanted to go back to was the fact that, you know, there's this game out there right now they got going on, and it's called Knockout, yeah. Where some of these young men are going to some of these communities, and they just run up behind, you know, unmistakably people and just knocking them out for whatever reason. And they're videotaping us. They're putting it on all this, the social media such as Facebook, you know, LinkedIn or Instagram or anything like that. And it's like, it's horrible. And I look at those individuals and I say, haven't you learned anything? Don't you see what you're doing to your own communities? You know, it's people like you that give the rest of the community a bad name because that's not the community as a whole. And when you have individuals,
why white people cross the street when they see a group of young black teenagers walking down the street.
And that's the truth. I mean, it's
some
the
black
fact
people
of the
do that as well.
Some black people do that.
I know. Jesse Jackson does.
Yeah,
that.
Yeah. He said that in the statement the other day. But as I stated earlier, you know, Tony Preckwinkle of Cook County, the Cook County Board President, she said, hey, listen, you know, if you lived in Chicago, you looked at Cook County, the second largest jail in the country, you would think that only black people committing crimes because 90% of the population in Cook County are black. And that's just not the case in a town of 3 million plus people. And, you know, I can sort of understand where these younger individuals are coming from, but to put a point where you're going to commit crimes in terms of knocking individuals out, you have to stop at some level and say enough is enough already.
But the question of the people that you deal with, juvenile delinquents who've been incarcerated.
Yes.
What percentage of them do you know because you deal with them? Mm-hmm. Say, you know, thank God these people are behind bars, because if they were not behind bars, they would be out doing something else. Or what percentage of those people who you deal with on a daily basis, what percentage of them are going to have any opportunity to ever do anything positive in their life when they get out?
A lot of those individuals are not going to have an opportunity because the simple fact is most of those individuals go back to the same communities that they came from, where they have no resources in terms of mental health, no resources in terms of a good education, no chance of a job. And then on top of all that, you know, you can forget about earning any real income, period. Yeah. End of story, cut and dry.
I got two things. One is I think a lot of white people don't want to recognize institutional racism, right? If I were black, I would definitely be in prison, right? I would get arrested as I was a stupid, 17-year-old guy, but because I was white, I was let go. I like to say I was a victim of racial profiling one time because I had a ponytail and I was wearing a Public Enemy hat, and they figured I was from out of town, so they put me in cuffs, and when they realized I was a white guy, they said, well, you're a good kid. So I think white people often don't want to see that there is a bias against particularly black kids. But the question I want to have, particularly to you, Amisha, is you get a call from the governor or the president, and they say, look, we're going to change one thing to make things better, particularly for, poor black kids, and I'm going to make sure that things get a little bit better. What is the change that you want to see that the government can do?
Whew, that's a difficult question because I have 5,000 in mind. In the immediacy, I would probably say the drug laws.
Right.
Well, and in what way?
Because of the mandatory minimum sentencing that exists across the country. And I think that there are certain drugs that are more prominent within African-American communities that significantly carry higher sentences than drugs do in white communities that are probably used more so, but probably should carry the same weight.
But again, the attorney general recently said that mandatory minimums is being reviewed in drug cases. So that's a positive thing. There could be a change there. But again, how is that going to keep someone who is young and black looking for something to do? How is it going to keep them from doing some other illegal activity?
Thing is, there are several things that need to be done. He asked, could I choose one? One of the things that I would definitely suggest is to relook at what we're doing with the public school system. I do not agree with the closing of schools. The public school system has always been has been a fundamental part of education, specifically for people who are from impoverished backgrounds. So giving more money to those communities for those schools and not specifically depending on the tax burden for those areas is going to be an integral thing. We all know that most minorities go to schools with only other minorities. There's very little actual intermingling between the race when it comes to the public school system. But if you're funding it almost entirely by the tax basis of those communities where we already know people are largely impoverished, you're going to continually give those kids a bad process of, growing and finding jobs post-education.
John Kuchelko.
Well, I have a different perspective on this. I think we live in the world that liberalism has wrought. Since Lyndon Johnson declared war on poverty in the mid-60s, we have spent oceans of money supposedly to eradicate poverty, and everything has gotten demonstrably worse. Black families were much stronger in the 1950s and the early 60s before this. Illegitimacy has skyrocketed. Crime has skyrocketed. The kind of hopelessness that you refer to has skyrocketed, and this has all been under the aegis of big and expanding government and ever-expanding government programs that supposedly are going to solve these problems and don't.
Well, to go to this answer, last week or so, the town of Naperville, one of the most affluent cities in the state of Illinois, they just said, we see a problem with heroin in our community, and we're going to donate twice as much as what we have been in the past to eradicate, to help educate for mental instability, for drug usage, and overall education on certain issues that affect the younger generation. So, money's not everything, but money does go a long way, and it plays an integral part of moving the conversation forward in some of these communities. In some of these communities, that money that you speak of, it didn't really reach those people who were the most affected.
That's my point. Money's been wasted. I mean, a lot of this money has been spent, but it didn't resolve the problems that it was.
It also hasn't. Get back to your point. And people who have listened to this program for years know what I'm about to say. You've heard me say this before. In my view, insofar as government's role in anything, any dollar not spent on education is a diversion. It's a diversion. Because until you have a school system where kids can go and learn and be safe, and the quality of teachers are at a proper level, and the teachers are properly paid, and they have some power to make that school a community center more than just a building that closes at 3:15 in the afternoon, schools have got to be more part of solving some of these issues. Because we live in a society where, and this is where I agree with a lot of teachers, the quality of the students that are coming to their schools these days is not as high a quality as it was 15, 20, 30 years ago, because there are too many parents who don't care.
But there's also,
they don't care about their kids.
Look, Bruce, I think you're absolutely right. But there's also way too many families that can't, no family can make it on one wage earner anymore. And when wages are this low and both parents have to work, well, who's going to help raise those children, especially if you're a low paid employee? So I think part of the answer to poverty, it seems obvious, but we sort of miss it, is having people get paid a lot more money for the work that they do so that they can afford to raise their children better.
Right. I wouldn't necessarily say, in some cases it is that the parents just don't care, but I wouldn't necessarily say that that is the case for the majority of situations. I know parents who work two and three jobs to make sure that they keep the lights on and are able to buy clothes to send their kids to school. Obviously, those parents aren't the ones who are going to be able to attend PTA meetings, sit down and do homework with their kids. They're maxed out. Like, they're right. working to make right. sure that things happen for them. And I think that, especially in minority communities, that's something that should be taken a lot more seriously when it comes to the schools and school districts and the money that is allocated there and the role that specific teachers have to play. Teachers aren't just teaching their kid, those children. They're also social workers. They're dealing with so much. When you have a kid who's going to school in a gang-ridden neighborhood, he's just worried about whether or not he can get to school and back without getting shot. That's not the same case for your average kid going to school in neighborhood.
Most suburbs, in affluent suburbs in the city or outside of the city. It's just not the case.
So how is that going to get better? John, let me ask you the question that Dan posed. If the president said to you, John, you get one wish to deal with just this particular issue, what would you do?
Elect a Republican president and a conservative majority in the Senate that will fire up the country's economy and provide the jobs that people need so that we can have the economic progress people want.
That's trickle down. That's prior to
2008.
We had a great economy for most of the years Bush was in there. We had a great economy.
We also had jails that were still loaded with African Americans and kids who were still left behind educationally.
We have the largest dropout rates in the nation. You can't blame President Bush for the crime rate in cities. What I'm saying is if you get an economy that is stronger than the one we have today, if we had had a Republican president for the last 5 years, you would be denouncing him and blaming him for the fact that there's all this unemployment and people are not being paid enough. But because we have Barack Obama in the White House, it has nothing to do with him. It's just an endemic problem of our society that has nothing to do with the president.
The thing is, the economy was considered extremely strong in the 90s, and we still had these same problems. So you can't just say that it's an economic issue solely, and just having a good economy
it's also a cultural issue. It's also a parental issue. It's also about the responsibility. When you make a baby, you have a responsibility for that child for the rest of their life, not only yours. Back shortly from Chicago, I'm Bruce Dumont. Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. Thank you very much for joining us wherever you're listening to this broadcast from coast to coast and border to border. Our guests around the round table, and it is a round table. Let's start with Anthony Anderson. Anthony, tell everybody a little bit about yourself. You're a former Marine. People should know that.
Yes, I'm a former Marine. I was in Marines from 1988 to 1992.
Where did you serve?
I was in California. I was in Kuwait, Operation Desert Storm, Desert Shield, Saudi Arabia, over in Europe. Japan, Korea, Operation Team Spirit, Operation Bear Hunt.
What was your training?
I was military 2512. That was communications. I did switchboard. I did satellite communications, telephone communications, anything dealing with communications I was a part of.
And how did you get involved in the criminal justice system?
Actually, I left the Marines after I left out. I came into Illinois. I came back home. And a friend just happened to tell me about the Department of Corrections because I have never heard of the Department of Corrections prior to me even applying for the job. And so I applied for the job. They told me, hey, Anthony, we saw that you passed the exam and we want you to come work for us. I said, okay, fine. They told me where it was. It was in Danville, Illinois. I said, okay, fine. I'll go down to Danville. And I looked on the map and it said F-18. I'm like, where's F-18? I looked down. It was cleaned by Champaign-Urbana. I was like, are you serious?
You thought it was a suburb?
Yeah, I thought it was a suburb. I didn't know where the prison systems were. You know? And I went clean down to Danville. I was there for 2 years. Next thing you know, I transferred back up this way. I've been through several institutions. I was at Danville Correctional Center. It's an adult division.
But explain to the audience, because for those listening around the country, you are African-American mm-hmm. and you are a Republican. Mm-hmm. Why are you a Republican?
I think the Republican Party lines up with most of the ideals that I believe in terms of individual responsibility, personal accountability, and those things. That's the thing that pushed me forward to where I am today. And I've always believed in self and a person's ability to do what they do. One of the things that I guess hurts me inside is the fact that, you know, when I was young, I was 17 years old, and I signed up for the military right out of high school. And once I signed up, I saw that many of us African-Americans were signing into the military. Fast forward to today, it's like no one thinks about the military. It's more of an afterthought, and that really bugs me, because I think in America, part of the problem with black people, for instance, is they consider themselves blacks before they consider themselves Americans. And that's a big problem. That's a hurdle that we have to get over in order for us to, I guess, assimilate to our society. And I think if that'll go a long way in terms of, black people become more productive in this society.
Amisha Cross, tell everybody a little bit about yourself. You're Miss Black Chicago of 2013.
Miss Black Chicago 2013, and I am with Enroll America. I did want to touch on something that Anthony just said. I think that it's definitely true that most blacks in America consider themselves black before American, but I also think that that's part of being a hyphenated American. And the fact that the media often plays up certain situations within the black community as related to them outside of being related to America as a whole. So there's a lot of isolationism, I think, that happens.
Such as
violence, such as systemic poverty, such as reliance on social programs.
Prison population?
The prison population.
Is that fair? Is that fair?
I don't think it's fair.
Is it a miscalculation?
The numbers are definitely correct. That's not something that I will argue against, but I do think that everything that goes into that process is often forgotten about. So it makes it look like or appear in terms of, from a media perspective, that all black people are more conducive to this type of lifestyle, or the majority of black people are going to do this. So it kind of diminishes the level of opportunity or the level of goal setting in some senses that African-American communities have.
But to go back to something we talked about in the recently, and that is this this game that is being played in some urban areas called Knockout, where literally people come up and knock people out. Most of those that are perpetuating
it's urban areas, primarily by African Americans, but it's towards white Americans.
Right.
It's towards white Americans, and it's also less than 1% of the population that is actually making these things happen. So I think that for the most part, the media is actually extrapolating this situation and making it a lot larger than it happens to be. It's a very isolated incident in most situations.
But wouldn't you think the situation would be tenfold the other direction if it was a bunch of white kids going around knocking black folks out? What would you think about it? I think somebody would get shot
if it was happening the other way.
But they don't play up to that whole mantra there. I mean, because if that were to happen on the obverse, then guess what? This place would be going up in flames.
The thing is,
people would say, look what happened with Trayvon.
Right.
In Sanford, Florida.
It would be reversed. But I also think that
the media as a whole in the United States looks for a negative story every time there is something positive that comes out for African Americans.
That's not only a negative story, but that's actuality. That's reality.
The point that
Anthony made, which I thought was a good one, and that is those African Americans who perpetrate these crimes, they are perpetuating a bad stereotype for blacks, which hurts blacks.
They may think
that they've got a one because they've got a picture of somebody knocking down an old, white woman on the street. They may think there's macho in that. The point is they are hurting black people and the image of black people, and it's perpetuating it in many ways, and that's unfortunate. Let's go to our other introductions. We spent a lot of time on our introductions tonight.
That's right.
Dan Johnson, tell everybody about your background. Because you're on this show frequently.
Oh, thank you. So, and it's a delight to be here. So I'm an attorney and a lobbyist in Illinois with a firm called Progressive Public Affairs. And my little anecdotal claim to fame is one of my teachers in law school was Barack Obama, who said, I don't know if I've ever told you this, one time he said, Dan, how much do you think you need to make to, survive? Because, I was an activist in law school and didn't go the corporate route. I said, I don't know, $30,000? He went, you got to think about this, Dan. I'm worried about you. He said that.
Well, that's good.
Yeah.
Whatever happened to him, by the way?
Yeah.
John Conchelco also joins us. John, tell everybody a little bit about your background.
Well, I was in local government for a long time. I was town assessor. I was a town trustee before that. I served on the school board. I've been president of the community chest. I've been active in a lot of civic organizations, worked with the Chamber of Commerce for many years, Kiwanis, Rotary, the Knights of Columbus. I've been very active in a variety of things, active in my parish. And I love doing public speaking. I portray public figures,
right.
FDR, Abraham Lincoln, Theodore Roosevelt, Charles Dickens, John F. Kennedy. We've heard so much about Kennedy the last few weeks.
Give us a little bit of John Kennedy.
And so, my fellow Americans, ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country.
Not bad.
Very good.
Not bad.
That's Anthony, a good one. Now, it's your turn. You're in the spotlight now. Okay, you were going to talk about a topic. We, you know, we spent a lot of time talking about your background, but what's a topic that's near and dear to your heart? That and it could be in you know, an elaboration on what we've already discussed. But what do you think is under the radar that needs to be discussed?
The overt inequality that exists in our society, and the overall fact that, you know, I don't think it's really being addressed. I think that, you know, even though I may not agree with Obama on a lot of issues, I think that he could be addressing a lot of this. The inequality exists throughout this country. I mean, and whether you're a Democrat or Republican, it doesn't make a difference.
In what way? How would you address it?
One way is through our educational system. Like Mitch was saying earlier, I mean, depending on what zip code you're from, it depends on what type of education you're going to get or you're going to receive. And that's pretty much unfair. And it's part and parcel to the problem to where you have this systemic, you know, underculture in the black community, which, you know, they just can't assimilate no matter what. They can't find their way in our society for the simple fact that, you know, they weren't given an opportunity early in life. And studies have shown the earlier you catch on to a lot of these problems that we're having in society, the faster or the quicker that we're going to be settling some of these problems. And society just hasn't figured out the fact that you're going to pay for this on the front end or the back end.
What would you do, again, during this campaign for president? Barack Obama would occasionally talk about parenthood, black parenthood, and talk about the responsibility of staying home and reading with your kids. I mean, he became parent-in-chief in many cases, and to some, he still is. What would you do to try to break the issue or break the stain of illegitimacy in the black community? And by the way, it is not just in the black community. It's all over. But again, it is predominant in the black community. What would you do to stem the tide of illegitimacy?
The one thing that you can do is simply educate. I mean, there's nothing else you can probably do, Bruce. I mean, in my best estimation, having an educated public or an educated individual to deal with to begin with is going to be the key. For the most part, you have a lot of people who are having these kids who are kids themselves.
Right.
And so, you know, parenting skills never – that thought never entered their mind as to, you know, how I'm going to raise a kid or what's best for me or what's best for us as a family.
Amisha.
That's one area where I do agree with the majority of Republicans on. I do think that family is very important and that obviously it is foundational when it comes to future success. But I also think that what we really need to look at is – restructuring in terms of role modeling for these communities. Most people within two-parent households who go on to get married as they grow up and go on to college and all those situations, they are automatically conducive to it in a lot of ways because they saw it. Mm-hmm. Within the African-American community, you don't see that. Even from my own background, I grew up in a single-parent household. I didn't meet my dad until I was a senior in college. So it was a very difficult process. And for me, it's like I can't even talk to anybody about what fatherhood is or see that because it wasn't something that I had growing up. I have no recollection of it, no understanding of it whatsoever, aside from what I see in movies or what I've read in books. And I think that happens for a lot of African Americans.
Can there be a learning moment with the 3 years that he has remaining? Because, again, Barack Obama, I mean, you may disagree with him as president of the United States, but I would hope there's not many people who are listening to this broadcast this evening that do not admire him as a husband and as a father. That is a beautiful family, a beautiful family. How does the beauty of that family get communicated to young African Americans about what family can be? Because he you know, and he didn't come from a perfect background himself. I mean, it's not like, he had a lot of struggles, but yet he was able to get his act together and become a great husband and father.
I think he's doing it. He's showing that it's possible. But in addition to that,
right,
you don't want to make it sound preachy, because one of the things that right, Barack Obama has done, and I think that he toes a very thin line there, is telling black men specifically, hey, this is what you need to do. You need to be in your kids' lives. You need to be in these households. You need to be going through the development process. You need to be able to time when you're having kids, not go outside and have multiple families at once, and really take this responsibility. But you have to do
preach
that in a way, yes, without people turning their ears off.
Back shortly from Chicago, I'm Bruce Dumont. Bruce Dumont back in Chicago, and Dan Johnson, it's your turn. What topic do you think is below the radar?
I want to talk about the federal gas tax. and our infrastructure. Right, right. Everybody's turning off the radio. Truckers are falling asleep at the wheel. Crashes on the highways. What a segue. Our highways. So most people kind of think that highways kind of pay for themselves, right? Most people are unaware that the Highway Trust Fund is broke. We've been taking, I think it's $45 billion out of general revenues to put into the Highway Trust Fund. And our transportation funding system has really changed in this country. Traditionally, Republicans have said, I don't like spending on welfare. I don't like spending on education. But I like infrastructure.
Building roads.
I like that.
Jobs.
Yeah, that's a good thing. But that's changed in Washington. The Tea Party folks, they don't like it. They don't want to spend money on anything, including roads and transit and trains. And as a consequence, the politics have shifted. And now usually it's every 6 years you sort of cover transportation. Well, we're in a new era in our country that has had a lot of discussion. And we're underinvesting significantly. And now you even see it, like, nobody's talking about raising the gas tax to pay for infrastructure, even though the engineers who study it say, look, we're at a D minus, right? We had a bridge collapse, you know, just a few months ago. Luckily, no one was on it. The bridge in Minnesota collapsed last year. You could look at our bridges. You know, they're all 50 years old, sometimes 100 years old. But as a country, it's like we don't want to face it. We don't want to say if you want to maintain our infrastructure, we have to raise our taxes, probably the gas tax because we're used to pay for it. And one more thing I want to add. I went to a conference last week in Washington, and the industry that's now taking the lead on saying, hey, we got to educate Americans about this, are the travel industry, hotels, airlines, convention bureaus, because they see if people can't actually get to where they want to go because the traffic is so bad, because we're not expanding our capacity, airports are getting more crowded, then the tourism and travel industry is going to suffer significantly.
John, what do you think of this?
We had a line in Springfield when I was there. We said, you should rise above the issues and vote for concrete. and
sounds,
I mean,
like Al Ronan.
And oddly enough, it was often the liberal Democrats that didn't want to vote for the kinds of things. It was the Republicans that were the big road builders,
right,
and bridge builders.
And prison builders.
Yeah. But I do have an agreement. We need to be looking at roads, bridges, harbors, railroads, all that fundamental infrastructure. That's what made America, yeah, the greatest nation in the world at the end of the 19th and 20th, at the beginning of the 20th centuries. And we can't allow that to deteriorate. So I would be supportive of the idea.
And it's also a significant jobs program. It seems to me that,
sure,
you know, I mean, that's
Eisenhower, after
Eisenhower
all, he was the man that built the
interstate highway,
highway system.
So I would say even this. So, you know, a bit of a ding on President Obama. I learned, you know, of course, Eisenhower was a great infrastructure president with the Eisenhower Interstate Freeway System.
But, you know, it had it was the Interstate Defense Road. But
right.
Everybody drops that term.
That's
it was
right.
The Interstate Defense Highway System, because Ike knew that in World War II there was a real problem, that the railroads were so overloaded, there was a question of whether we could move material from coast to coast.
Right.
It had a definite military connotation during the Cold War.
And even the interstate now, every 5 miles, one of those miles has to be straight on Desenero so that a plane can land on runway.
That's right.
Say that one more time.
So on every interstate, every 5 miles, there is 1 mile that is dead on straight, because in an emergency, that can act as a runway.
You know, it's funny that you bring
that
back
up.
Hey, I knew that too, but the fact of the matter is, back when I was younger, we used to discuss that, and they said the one reason why they did that was because in the black community, on a Kennedy or an Eisenhower, not the Kennedy, but the Dan Ryan here in Chicago, in case those guys got rowdy in those projects, because the projects surrounded both on the east and west of the Dan Ryan.
It was the
and
block.
Just in case they got out of control, they could land a plane in that area and quell any.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Right.
That's what we were told.
Well, but the expressway separated the black and white communities.
Yeah, that's
right.
True.
But one thing I learned at this conference, which is fascinating, Ronald Reagan raised the gas tax in his first term, ran on it in 1984 to go into the Highway Trust Fund, and won in a landslide. Bill Clinton raised the gas tax in his first term. It mostly went to deficit reduction, ran on it, got reelected. Barack, you know, was raising the gas tax was not part of it. You know, we were in such a deficit. You know, there wasn't much infrastructure in the stimulus.
Well, that was part of his shovel-ready projects when he first started this.
There were some. It was,
but that would seem to be a direct link to creating jobs.
Absolutely.
That were government-generated jobs. But again, if you want to put people to work, you got to build something.
Yeah. So there's an opportunity now to do old-fashioned public works, which works, so to speak, at employing people and helps our economy. But the politics of today, that's not getting much resonance, not getting much traction. And it's mostly an interesting debate within the Republican Party, because the new wave, the Tea Party folks, they don't think like you do, former representative. They're not interested in the same infrastructure investment. And in the next year or so, it's going to be fascinating to see who the nominee is and if they're willing to be an infrastructure type of president or just an anti-everything.
Do you see the Tea Party, John, as a positive element within the Republican Party?
I do. I think they've been overly maligned. I think that they're held up to criticism as a bunch of fanatics. They're basically constitutionalists. They're basically people who say government is too big. I think some of this opposition to infrastructure is they feel government has gotten so big and so enormous that they're against everything. I mean, they don't want to spend money on anything because they're jaded on the fact that we've spent so much money where it should not be spent. But in general, I think they've been a positive force. They brought enthusiasm. They certainly played a role in the Republican landslide in 2010 when the House flipped and the Senate could have flipped if a few races had gone differently. So I think they've been a positive factor.
Well, the Senate could have flipped if the Tea Party wasn't an integral part of some primary fights and nominated someone who couldn't win a general election.
But it cuts both ways.
Well, it did. But
the establishment
but again,
has nominated some losers, too. I mean, you know, the establishment has foisted some losers on the party, too. They both have their hands.
Equal opportunity here, in that respect. On that note, we are out of time for our guest, Anthony Anderson, who is with the Republican Precinct Project in Illinois. Amisha Cross, Miss Black Chicago, and also with Enroll America's joined us. Dan Johnson from Progressive Public Affairs. And John Kochelka, who is a noted entrepreneur.
Public speaker.
Tomorrow is the last day to turn in those petitions to the county clerk's office here in the state of Illinois.
There you go. For everybody listening in California, it could mean less. But in Illinois, that was a very important statement. On that note, we are out of time for this week. This program is a Genevieve production, produced in association with WLS Talk Radio. Our thanks to Tom Veracruz and Dan Dorfman for their assistance in the production of this program. Until next week, this is Bruce Dumont. Good night from Chicago.